This episode of Yes But Why Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
Do you travel a lot when you go? I mean, you're going to Atlanta immediately. Did you start somewhere else? Meaning not home?
No, this is a longer trip, but Austin was first. So I'm now doing a trip from Austin to Atlanta to, where is that? Rauental in Germany, and then Dubai, and then back to Amsterdam.
So crazy.
Wow.
That doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
Look at this globe.
No.
Are there like festivals that have requested you to go, or did you just sort of arrange it?
Atlanta was planned because I was in Atlanta last summer and we wanted to come back and to work again with Dad's Garage because I was very inspired by their work and they wanted to work with me and my fiance, Gael. And so we planned that. Then Austin invited me the Improvised Play Festival, so I added that to it. And then I realized I'm meeting my European improv group in, we always meet in Germany, in this cute little German town that no one knows, Rauental. So I was like, you know what, instead of like flying back to Amsterdam and being home for a few days and then go all the way to Germany, I'll just fly back to Germany. And then recently I got a corporate improv gig in Dubai and it just made more sense to go straight from Germany, because if I go back to Amsterdam first, I'll have to fly all through the night, and I don't like that.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's very jet-setter. It's, yeah.
Are you planning some other tour, or is this the tour?
Planning a world tour.
So all that she just said is not a world tour.
It's the previous to the world tour.
I mean, that's a rock star right there.
Right.
You warm up your world tour with a world tour.
Yeah, not even, I didn't go around the world twice, so it doesn't count as a world tour.
Yeah.
Man, that must be wild.
It is. It's pretty wild. It's very cool that I'm in a position where I can, I have enough network to make that happen. And that, I can, the people want me there and I speak a language that's spoken enough over the world that I can do that. Like, all of that comes together, which is really cool. And the world tour, I'm doing a lot of, off and on traveling. And then I talked to my fiance about that, and he does that a lot too. And then we were like, how about we connect all those travels and just pause our classes in our respective hometowns for a year and then do that world tour. So, yeah. So that's the plan now.
Hey, man, if you can do it.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely.
Exactly. It's because I can. That's why. Yeah.
I mean, people want you to travel to their town to do stuff. It's like, might as well go in there, you know. Hey, everyone, I'm great.
The great thing about improvisers is they tend to say yes.
Yeah.
So you're just like, hello, people in this Australian city that I've never been to. You don't know me, but we know some of the same people. How about I come by and I could teach workshops? And a lot of times they say yes.
So a story I've told a bunch is the first time I went outside of the U.S. for improv, which kickstarted the whole rest of my life, sort of, was the Finland Improv Festival. And I saw an announcement on the Austin Improv Forums, which nobody goes on anymore, but I saw this announcement. And I made a message to my troupe as a joke and said, hey guys, let's go to Finland for improv. And they all were just like, yes, holy crap. Oh, my God, let's raise money. Let's do this. And they just were rattling off ideas. And I was like, shit. And I didn't say anything specifically. And I made the decision to wait until we had all arrived in Finland and all five of us were gathered together at the pub with our beers. And I finally said, guys, I was joking. Like, I was not serious about this at all. But it's great. It was like, it was a lifelong lesson, which I've passed on to many other people, that you should never joke with improvisers, which sounds strange, but they will yes and that until you are in Finland at an improv festival. And that led to everything else. Like, the next year, Trent was looking for teachers, and I had never taught at a festival before, but I thought, I'm a teacher. And he knew me from the previous year, like you say, you have that little network. And then from there, I met other people, and boom, boom, boom. And now I have a Dutch girlfriend. Not Laura, but Laura's best
Right on.
friend. Yeah.
I feel like there's a distinct group that is the sort of international improvisers I'm starting to realize. Certainly from previous interviews that I've done, and then also like, so I'll do previous interviews and then I'll look at mutual friends and it's the same
Beep, boop,
people.
boop,
So
boop.
I'm like, okay, cool, I'm getting the right crowd here.
Yeah.
And then so sometimes that's how I find new guests. If I call you randomly, that's why. It's just because I'll see somebody and it's like, you're the only mutual friend I don't know. And then I send a message, hi, you want to do this? Because it's like they're probably another person who travels and does this kind of stuff. So it's always interesting to experience that. Plus, you're right about like improvisers. The nice thing is, if you're traveling with improvisers, there's sort of like a welcoming nature, there's like a positivity. And if you're like, I'm not sure how to do this, they're like, we'll figure it out. We'll build
Yeah, there's like a
it.
social circle, and you'll go to any given festival, and there'll be just a cross section of the same group of people. You know, oh, Dave Rozowski's here. You know, or what have you?
Yeah. What were the other festivals that you have gone to after the Finland one? Like, what was your journey after that?
I went to Impro Amsterdam, which is where I met Kiki. I met Laura in Finland, actually. Met my girlfriend in Amsterdam. I've been to the Mount Hill Improv in Athens. South Africa is the farthest I've ever gone for improv, which was, a wild trip. And was exactly a result of just sending an email and being like, hi, I saw you have a festival in 6 months. That was kind of adorable because I emailed both producers, and one of them meant to reply to the other and say, oh, I really like his workshop descriptions. Can we squeeze him in? But accidentally did a reply all. So I got to be still here, guys.
I bet you can squeeze me in. Come
Yeah,
on.
exactly. I got you. Yeah,
That's so
so
funny.
Estonia more recently, and I hopped all over. I had an improv format that, as a performance that I took to, I forget the number, but six different countries, 12 different states, or something like that. And throughout all of that, I was getting to know people and making new networking connections and more Facebook friends. And yeah, it turned into a self-sustaining thing past a certain point.
Was it the do you think that the travel was like, like you kept it going, you kept emailing, you kept seeking out the opportunities, or what, once you put up the show with the format, do you think the format got interest and people called you and were like, hey, we saw this format, I'd love to do that at the our festival?
It was a bit of both. I don't recall whether anybody ever literally approached me before I would always apply,
Sure.
but they knew either because they'd seen it themselves or they knew by reputation, oh, this plays well at a festival. So, yeah, it was a cool thing. And now I've retired that format, but I still have the friends that I've made, and I get to teach here and there. And I have a new format with my girlfriend that we've taken a couple of places. So, yeah, just keep going from there.
Right on.
Yeah, it's neat.
A little bit earlier, when you started the story about Finland, you said that's when I got back into it. Tell me what happened. That seems to indicate there was a time you were not into it. What happened before that?
So I started improv 17 years ago, but the asterisk is that there was a 5-year gap in there when I was married. It wasn't,
Ah.
I mean, it's correlation is not causation, but the more I got into the marriage, the less I was into improv. And then I went through the bulk of my marriage just not involved in improv at all. I still had the loose connections, as the marriage was on the decline, I started to kind of I don't know of a good way to tell this story, but I went specifically to the Hideout Theater 10th anniversary show, where there was kind of a open call. Anybody who's ever been at the Hideout, come back for the 10th anniversary. It was like a reunion. And I got on the stage and I was like, this is my family. Oh my God, why did I ever leave? This is so incredible. And I literally had to be pulled off the stage, I remember, because I had done my segment of the show. And then I was just off to the side watching the show. But I kept jumping on as side support, which I'm not proud of. It was not cool of me, but I was just that much into it. Like, I had missed it so much. And finally, Andy Crouch, like, just pulled me playfully, but also seriously, pulled me off of the stage, and which was totally fair of him. So, got back into it, and troops formed, and here we are. Yeah.
It's interesting how some relationships can take you away from the creative part of your life. Does mm-hmm. that happen to you as well, Laura?
Well, totally. So I was in a relationship with a traveling improviser, and when we broke up, I was like, was I... Because before that, I hadn't been traveling, and I wasn't even doing that much improv. So I had to sort of like do some soul searching of, was I doing the traveling and the improv for me, or was that because I was in a relationship with him? Mm. And then I did some improv festivals and workshops internationally on my own, and I realized, yes, this is mine. But then also, if I'm not going to like... piggyback on his career, then I have to do it myself. So I kind of remember this moment a few months after our breakup, like, I need to do this myself now. And I sort of like, so I like approached my network and I just went for it. Mm-hmm. And then within a very short time, I got to teach everywhere and I got my network activated and they knew that I wanted to travel and I wanted to teach. And that's how that happened. And so I think I've been single then for 4 or 5 years, and all this time I'm realizing, like, I'm thinking, like, oh, if I'm back in a relationship, I'll have to stop this. Mm-hmm. I cannot be away from home that much. I cannot be like partying at festivals all the time. So this inner belief of like, oh, this, the being single is part of this life. And then I met another traveling improviser. And we're now engaged, and we actually get to travel more because now we're operating as a team. I can actually bring a show, which I couldn't. I had to only bring myself a teacher. So this moment of I don't have to give up my passion just because I'm in a relationship was huge. Yeah. It was huge for me.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, there is a lot of, you know, it's like giving of yourself when you're in a relationship. Like, you have to share with somebody else part of who you are and part of what you're interested in, and then have that, like, it's okay that we're not interested in all the same things kind of conversation, where it's like, it's okay. Like, I didn't want to date me.
Yeah.
So I'm super glad you like these things, you know? Yeah, it's funny because when you mentioned it, and I'm glad that you felt connected to the idea too, because I totally did. I didn't start improv until after a terrible relationship. Like, I didn't even know anything about improv.
So many people to improv classes is the ends of terrible relationships.
I mean, that's what got me to Austin to begin with. Yeah, I was in a terrible relationship in Dallas with a guy that I had gone to college with, you know, years before. This is many, many years. It wasn't like right after college. This was like 10 years after college, reconnect. Terrible. Don't do that. And my girlfriends from college had all moved here and were like, get away from that guy. Come back. Stay with us. Live with us. And so when I broke up with him, I moved in with them. And then I was like, what am I going to do with myself? And I had not done theater the entire time we'd been together. We had dated for like 2.5 years. I had moved from New York City, where I was performing like every night, to live in Dallas with him. And then it was like, why am I here? What's going on? Yeah. Why would I do this? Like, I didn't even do Dallas theater. Right. Like, there's theater to be done. There's improv.
Yeah, there's stuff.
There's like a whole scene. But I was just like, no, I guess I'm just this guy's girlfriend now. Like, what? I don't know.
Lost yourself in there.
Yeah, yes. And then when I broke out, the first thing I did was went to Cold Town, saw a show, and was like, okay, how do I do this?
Give me back. Yeah. Give me back.
Yeah.
That's great.
So I was like, I gotta get involved with this kind of thing. So if you're having a tough time in a relationship, audience, improv can help.
Yes.
It really is helpful.
Yeah, I mean, my wife never discouraged me from doing it, but I just let myself get drawn very ever so gradually away from it, you know, and you forget how much you love it, you know? And
yeah. All of my creative energy was focused on trying to get my boyfriend to play his guitar outside of the house. He was an amazing guitarist. Like, to this day, I will say he's probably the best musician I've ever heard ever. Like, famous people included. I'm sorry, Michael Jackson, you're very good and I like you. But no, this man was an amazing guitarist. And I was always like, let's go to an open mic. Let's go out. Let's get you to go. And he's like, no, it's too nervous for that. So I'm like, okay, let's lower the stakes. I'm like, let's find a church. Like, it's like, what's lower? What's a thing that's like not as scary?
Yeah.
You know? And he just would never go. And it broke my heart. And I was like, I will never let people with creative talent not work on their talent ever again. Mm-hmm. So it's like totally, I think about him all the time when I teach. Because it's like, when I see people that are good that I feel like are going to give up, I'm like, nope, yes. No, yes. You are not giving up. And let me tell you why you're not. Yeah. You know, because it's important to like maintain that. It's like my whole thing.
And was Michael Jackson a good guitarist?
No, but as a musician, he's pretty good at stuff.
That's not the important part of the story. But I got hung up on that.
I know. It was just like in my mind, I was like, who's the best musician ever? Yes. Michael Jackson. Yes. Like, if I were to be in a desert island and I was like, you get one discography, I'd take him.
Totally.
It's fine. Yeah, yes. I mean, all the, you know, that with the island CD players that they have available.
They give you those. Oh, that would suck if you could only take the CDs.
But not the... It's you with a hatchet, like, trying to make a CD player on a tree. You're like, I got this!
I'm just reading the lyrics and singing them aloud. Oh, that'd be so sad.
Oh, man. I hope they have the lyrics. I have a lot of albums of Michael Jackson. Rarely did they have the lyrics available.
That would always frustrate me when I would buy a CD and you'd open it and it was just like two pages without that. I want the lyrics. Yeah. I want to know what they're saying.
You know, I'm a non-native speaker. I know them phonetically.
Right?
You know, when I grew up on Star Wars, I knew the aliens' lines as much as the humans' lines. Because I just knew it all phonetically.
Wow.
Yeah, I can just rattle off all the... Yeah, I can't really do it anymore. But like the Han Solo talking to Greedo in the bar, like I could do both parts. It was great.
Oh, yeah.
I was like a 6-year-old.
You watch a movie enough, for sure.
And I watched it a lot. Good times.
So switching gears from your current lives, I want to ask you guys a question about when you were little. What for you guys is your like first memory of you performing? And I don't mean the memory that maybe your family has told you, like, oh, you used to do this crazy thing. Not that, which you have no recollection of. The first time you remember performing for people. And it doesn't have to be on a stage, just any little thing, a bit or whatever that you did as a kid that maybe could be in your mind the spark, or at least your parents would go, oh, we knew.
Yeah.
Have you got
I totally got, yeah. So I was in dance classes from the age of 6, and then later, like age of 12, I went into musical, and then I went into theater, and then directing, and then improv. So that was sort of like the arc I took. And I will often say, like, I feel like in every part of that, I always felt like I was pretending to know what I'm doing, because I wasn't a talented dancer and I wasn't a talented singer and I wasn't a talented actress, and every time I'm just, you know, I'm just bluffing my way through it. And then with improv I'm like, ooh, this is the art of bluffing.
Finally a place.
I know how to do that.
You're in your element.
Yeah.
It took you a while.
Yeah, a little bit.
That's great.
And then dance, yeah, I remember. I think it's also my, of course it's one that has impact because you remember a strong emotion. So I was 6 and I was part of my first dance recital, and I played a What are the helpers on the boat again? What's that?
Helpers on
sailors.
The boat. Oh, the sailors.
Sailors.
There's a and crew.
I was thinking on a cruise, you have the people that make you the drinks and, like, you know, the helper
I
people.
I was six. I played one of the sailors, and I was one of the cleaners on the boat. Oh, this is vivid. Yes. So me and two other young girls were each holding a broom, and I even remember the dance routine. We had to. Sweep with the broom 3 times and then put the broom up and down and then walk around the broom, and that was our solo. Like, that was our little three person. That was our moment. And so I sweep once and twice, and the third time the bottom of the broom falls.
No.
Like, disconnects. And I'm looking at that part of the broom and, like, right in bright spotlight, and then also to the wings where my dance teacher was, and the two other girls on each side of me look at me like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, no, in the broom. And then the dance teacher that I look at is like, continue dancing, like, go on. But I'm like, I can't. My broom is broken.
There's a problem.
I cannot do the thing.
Stop the show.
And so the rest of the song continues that we were doing the rest of the thing. And the three of us were just looking at each other.
Staring.
Like, what is this? And then there's a black and the other three people have their moments. So, yeah, I remember that. And in general, I just really remember how much excitement there was to be on the stage. I was a scared child for sure, so it was felt very good to be part of a group and then to have the stage feeling but also feel safe.
Do you think they put you in classes because you were scared?
No, I think I just, looking back on it, I see that a lot of my choices as a child were a little bit out of fear, out of being afraid for most things. So, like, learning later how to fail and to be in the spotlight and all that, that was, those steps felt big. They felt huge for me. So, yeah. So that failure moment was also, like, it was enormous.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Neat.
Wild.
Yeah. I've always loved the stage. I always loved theater. I always thought I wasn't talented enough to be the one, in the front, in the spotlight. But I loved being around it. And I directed things and choreographed things. I did face paint. I helped. I was backing vocals, like all of that. And then it wasn't until I went into improv when I realized, oh, but this is my thing. And when I'm on stage, people actually ask me back.
Mm-hmm.
At first I thought, it was because they're nice.
They're just being nice.
Yeah, right? And after a while, you're like, well, this is getting a little too often to just be nice.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So it took a long time for me to sort of take that. So all right, I do belong on that stage. I am not just the teacher or not just the director or the helper. I can also be the performer.
That's great.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Very cool. I played Sir Bookworm when I was 6. It's like, you know, Bookworm, does that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was Sir Bookworm, and basically I just pulled a sleeping bag up to the halfway point. And I remember walking into a younger kid, let's say I was third grade, so it would have been maybe 8, and I walked into the second or the first grade classroom to perform this, the younger kids, and I only remember the first 2.5 lines. Hello, everybody. I'm so glad you came. Before I begin, let me tell you my name. I am Sir Bookworm. And there was more to it, but I don't remember the rest of it.
I can't believe people ever remember their lines for things. Like, people will rattle off speeches they did in high school. And I was like, I can tell you what I did yesterday.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Just that stuff, which I remember the preposition song. Just all the little memorization stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
That's
so wild.
And it might have been around then that I sang as Fievel the Mouse from American Tale, somewhere out there for a large audience. Yeah, it was. I don't know what it was, but it was in the main auditorium, and it was a duet with an older girl, and I was holding a little Fievel mouse doll, and my voice cracked in the middle of it because I was so nervous.
Perfect.
I know, it was adorable. I'm not sure which of those two things, but the thing is, I went my entire upbringing being a total ham and funny guy, but never performing in any way. It wasn't until college. And at the end of college, I had a brief part in a friend's play just because I wanted to experience it. But that was it. Meanwhile, my sister got her master's in playwriting and went to the Tisch School at NYU and has all these like, and now we're adults and she doesn't perform at all and I'm on stage all the time. So we've totally switched on that.
It is so interesting how, you know, it ends up that way. You know
Yeah.
what I mean? You see people who went to school and did it. Like, I keep track of almost all the people that I went to college with. And I went to a liberal arts school. It wasn't like a conservatory. There wasn't like, it wasn't NYU. Sorry, college. But you're not NYU. And, you know, I still try to keep track to like see how many of us are still doing it and like keeping on to it. And, you know, when they're not, I try to like get them. Like, I'll be like, hey, you should do this thing with me. Because it's like, you want to do
You want
it. Oh, yeah. No, I, my mom was very political when I was a kid. We went to lots of, sit-ins and we held picket signs and stuff. And my first performance was just entertaining people at a picket line doing bits. And I did a Julia Child bit that
Oh my
always killed.
gosh.
So yeah, as a child,
What a ham.
that's what I would do. I would just
Amazing.
wander around. They'd bring us to the political things, and I'd just swing around and talk to people. And I'm like 8, and I'm talking to them like I'm like an older lady. I'm like, oh guys, all right. Yeah, so I was just thinking about that the other day, and I thought, oh, that's gonna be my next time I talk to people, I'm gonna ask that question, because it was like, oh, and also I have a little baby too, and he's just about to turn 2, and every time I look at him, I'm like, isn't it funny how we are just ourselves? Like, no matter what happens to us from the moment we're out, we're like just being our own thing, because he'll make faces and reactions to things that we do not do. I'm like, do you do this? And my husband's like, no, I've never, you know, and everyone's just their own little character. And it's just fascinating to see how we, you know, we've all decided to be in theater and to work in our lives in this creative way. But like when we were little, it was there, this tiny little thing.
I have no idea why it took me. I don't know. I was also simultaneously a little introverted and nerdy and liked reading my Star Wars books, you know. So it just took me a while to finally crack that egg. And but there were moments of just hamming it up on stage here and there. And my dad's a preacher, so he was always the center of attention. So there was some little precedent for it, I guess.
I see. Don't take stage time from dad, eh?
I guess I'm not
Yeah.
sure like how that played in my psyche, but
Sure.
yeah, I got there eventually.
I remember that I had friends who were very much like taking the spotlight, very much like, look at me, I'm a star. And I've had several friends in different schools, different ages. And I always thought, I'm not like that. I'm not the person that comes into the room in a glitter dress. Like my friends would do that. Like, and or yeah, and be very loud and take up all attention, or just start singing in the middle of something. And I'm like, I'm not. So if I'm not like that, I probably should not be on the stage.
Oh, see, I think that's a huge, like, the idea of that is a huge misconception, because I think being like a lifetime person who works in theater and works in improv or performance is such a different animal than just, you know, being excited to be on stage. And I teach like a summer kids thing, and I have a one group that's middle school and one group that's high school. And by high school, they're already walls up, you know, so I can't tell too much about them. But the middle school kids, you can see, like you said, there are some people that are like, look at me, I'm the center of the stage. And you're like, okay, cool, you'll get your solo. Don't worry about it. Like, they come already in costume on like the second day. You're like, it's a 3-week camp. Like, the show's not for a while. But like, yeah, I had one girl like write a whole song and like bring it in, and I was like, okay. I was like, hey, you wrote a song, we're putting it on stage. Let's do it.
That's
But
great.
some of the other kids that were shyer, I could just see the spark in them. Like, I could see little bits where it was like, oh no, she's gonna be good. Oh, she's gonna do this her whole life. You know, because just being excited about it when you're 11 doesn't necessarily indicate the like fuel to continue the long journey of it.
Yes.
Same with what you were talking about. You're like, I don't know, it took me so long. I think it was just like you just needed to develop the fuel.
Yeah.
You know, you needed to, it's almost like somebody who wants to write a book but has to live their life long enough to know what happens in a book. Because it's like, oh, yes. Oh, right, life adventures. I should probably have one before I try to write one down. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So, I mean, there's yeah. something about allowing yourself the chance to live your life and do 100 different things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's too much of an insistence on 18-year-olds to have their whole lives figured out.
Yes. I'm so happy that at the age of 18, when I had to make a decision what I was going to study, that I didn't feel like theater school was something for me. Because I think if I would have gone at the age of 18 to an audition of any theater school and they would have burned me to the ground, I would have never stepped a foot in a theater anymore. So I'm very happy that I just got to do it as a hobby and for fun and no pressure until I was confident enough.
Well, yeah, and improv is a good way for non-theater people to... Like, when I started, I went to see my friend who did his graduation show and walked in there. Oh, I could use a hobby. Maybe this would be fun. And it wasn't good, the show I went to see, but that was such a relief because <Yes. laughs> if I had gone to see some main stage incredible production, I would be like, oh, no, I couldn't do that. But I saw people fumbling around and being idiots and, you know, just struggling to get through a scene, all in a delightful way. You know, it's their graduation show. And I just watched and thought, okay, I could do that. Like, so I feel like there's a parallel universe where they just rocked out that show. Like, they killed it. And Kevin was like, nope, never mind. And Kevin found a different hobby.
So. When you went to that show, were you, like, looking for a hobby?
Yeah, I remember going in there, or I remember in the months preceding that being kind of frustrated and feeling like all of my friends had a thing and I didn't have a thing. You know, I would just be online and playing random video games. And yeah, I didn't have a thing at the time. Yeah. I hadn't lived my life yet. I wasn't that interesting yet, you know?
Well, you know what? I also have this other theory. I've said this 1,000 times. Regular listeners, strap in. I have this 18-year theory. I believe that every 18 years you become a new person.
Ooh.
So you have to go through whatever that is and learn and change and develop.
Yeah.
And that sometimes in the midst of that, there are ebbs and flows of like intense creativity. Like sometimes there's nothing. Like you said, sometimes I'm just playing video games every day for months at a time.
Right.
Like doesn't matter. I've watched every show on Netflix now, it turns out. Like, whatever it is, you're just not being involved with creativity.
Yeah.
But I think it's because there's different, like, from 0 to 18, there is a kid who's growing up and figuring out what his life is like, right? Mm-hmm. By the time he's 18, we then go, hey, what's the rest of your life going to be like? Go.
Yep.
That's a huge decision for a person to make. But apparently, turns out, 18 years of living, enough to make a solid decision. So I say, if you're allowed after 18 years to make that kind of life decision, well, then 18 years after that, you should be able to make another one.
Makes sense.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part is forgiveness. Would you be mad at a 5-year-old for not knowing what they're going to major in college?
Right.
No, you probably wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you be mad at somebody who's 23 who doesn't know what they're going to be when they're 36?
Yeah.
You're not. You're like, be 23. Have a great time with that. Yeah. Be 5. Throw some paint. Like, it doesn't, you're not, you have to acknowledge that we ebb and flow in intensity of life. We're not just a hot burning flame the whole time.
No.
It's like we have to get fuel, we have to get new experiences, and also we have to go through educational parts where it's like, wait, you're telling me that if I do this, it'll cause that thing to happen? Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
The lessons I learned from 18 to 36 were a totally different series of lessons, but I think they're just as valid. And when after I became older than 36, audience knows I'm older than 36.
Okay.
I'm in a new part of my next one. So I'm 40 this year. So I'm 4.
Yeah.
I'm not worried.
What?
I'm only 4 years old. I'm
great.
Feeling like I'm hitting I don't know what I'm doing. Oh man, what are my creative goals? I don't know what they are. Let's see.
Yeah.
Keep treading water. I wouldn't be mad at a 4-year-old for not knowing.
Right.
You know, yeah. So same with, you know, 22. What do they know? They don't know, right? Yeah. Great. So turns out 40, just as easy. Right? So I just think that we should give ourselves the same kind of break that we would give other people. And I like to think of it in that cyclical way, because I think that people get frustrated with the way their lives are going and think like, okay, I guess that's it. I guess I'm not this kind of person. Right. I guess it turns out. And people like to have a lot of absolutes. And I was like, there are no absolutes. Mm-hmm. You could literally change what you want to do the day before you die. 82, you're like, I'm a singer now. And that's it. You're a singer for 2 days, best 2 days.
Right.
And that's it. I mean, why not, right?
I'm hearing that sometimes from people telling me, oh, so you found your passion. Like, what do you mean found? Right? Like, as if this is it for now.
Right.
This is it. But like, if I get bored with this, I'm sure there's another thing.
Yeah,
I have a similar, like, I've got, this isn't good for podcast format, but over here, I've got a tattoo on my right forearm of lightning in a bottle, which is a metaphor for improv, it was my first tattoo, and, I don't know, the stereotype is you immediately start wanting another tattoo, and I'm like, no, this is great, I like it, you know, I like having the one, but I sometimes think I've got my left forearm, and I'm just holding that in reserve. Because of the same thing, this is very unlike, maybe even most improvisers feel differently, that, you know, oh no, I love this, this is the love of my life. Well, it's the love of my life too, but there might be another one 20 years from now. I don't want to run improv at the old folks home when I'm 80, you know, I'll probably have some other hobby maybe. So my empty left forearm is my personal symbol for, if I ever find something I love as much as improv, then the symbol for it goes there. You know?
Oh yeah.
So that's my little, just saving in advance.
Nice, nice. So when you're like in your 60s, you become a fitness guru and you're selling fitness juice.
Or maybe I make model airplanes. I don't know. There's fun, so many hobbies, you know?
Yeah.
There are.
Well, because I often think about like how my life would have gone, and you know, the story I just told, like, what if I found something else that I loved and then suddenly I'm into this and that, and you know, I've got a tattoo of that on my right forearm, you know? Yeah. I don't know that I definitely would have come around to improv. Maybe I wouldn't have. Maybe I just would have lived a totally different life, you know?
Yeah. Wow, I like that you're, like, open to that idea, too, because I think that that's an important part of life, is, like, being open to the possibilities.
Yeah.
Because I tell people all the time, like, if you're not enjoying improv, don't do it. It's for fun. We're doing this for fun. You know, nobody's making money on this. You know, like, this is not a place you go to get rich and famous. So do it as long as you enjoy it, and go away if you're not enjoying it. And guess what? Improv will still be here. So come on back whenever you are in the mood. And it's great. It's just there. And a lot of people just keep going past the point that they're enjoying it and do it out of obligation. Kiki was telling me how she had to help break up this troupe that she was coaching.
Yes.
And just give them a come to Jesus talk of, y'all don't like each other. You're not enjoying this. And she really needed to give that tough love talk to them, because they were just going to keep doing it even as they weren't enjoying it. And I've been in improv projects myself where I'm just plodding along, you know, even things I was proud of. I just had to take a step back, because I could tell it would start to feel like a chore if I kept at it.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it's important to, like, when we are doing improv scenes, we are aware of their fleeting nature. We are aware of being able to live in them and enjoy them and then move past them. But our regular life adventures, we don't give the same credit to.
Yes.
Like, yeah, of course, that troupe could have been great if we had a nice 2 years, loved each other the whole time, and then we're like, on the 2-year anniversary, goodbye, everyone. Have a great rest of your time. Like, yep. 5 years later, and you're like, if Tyler does another introduction as a cook, I'm going to explode.
You better be listening, Tyler.
Yeah,
I have several improv friends named Tyler. So. You hear that?
Watch out, Tyler. I'm making an ad. Oh man.
Yeah, so it's good to keep friends, because we're doing this Buddhist mandala thing, you know. My therapist pointed out something to me. I'm always working on my house. I'm always building a new chicken coop or redoing this fence or fixing this. Or I just bought a new bedroom door to replace my bedroom door. Like, I'm just constantly finding something to putter around the house and buying new tools. And my therapist made this excellent point. He said, well, you do this improv thing, and the moment you do it, it's gone. It's gone forever. It just vanished. meanwhile, you have these things that you can point to and touch and say, "Look, touch this. I made it. It's not going anywhere." And I was like,
Yes.
"That's an interesting, yeah, I've got the two things. So maybe that's why I have this addiction to my home projects, is so I can feel tangible accomplishment about something, you know?"
Yeah, that's a fascinating kind of idea.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean nothing. I mean, obviously, I love improv and I love the relationships that have formed from it and all of this. But my hobby is not making something, you know. It's not pottery. It's making dreams, you know.
Yeah, and it's whether I played a good show or a bad show, it will be over after an hour, right? It's sort of like, so even if I don't feel like it or like this will be terrible, well, it will definitely be over. Like, and it, I can very much relate to this feeling of making something tangible. Like I did a, I had a podcast as well for a little bit, and I wrote articles about improv. And because my improv career, like the last year or so, I got a lot of invitations to teach, so I did a lot of that. And now I'm starting to really miss the making something where you can point and say, "Mommy, I made
I made it.
it,"
Look,
and
mommy.
it's still there. So I'm now trying to, oh, maybe I should actually say no to these beautiful invitations or opportunities, but start making again because that keeps the balance of this art that just goes away.
Yeah. I haven't been in a production in a while. Like, I don't know. I mean, you've got your neighborhood, you know, sketch group. Are you still active in that? Is that still active?
No, I
It's
just
not.
finished that in November.
Oh,
8 years
wow.
I stopped it because
Amazing.
I was getting to that point. I was
Oh,
like, I have put together this show every month for 8 years. It's too much.
That's great.
And
I'm proud of
I
you.
did it for a full year and a half after I had the baby. Like, I only took for
Yeah.
the record, I only took 4 months
Listen up,
off for
Tyler.
maternity, and
Wow.
I produced that show for a year and a half with a newborn baby. And when he got older, and when I was still doing it, but I was a little more disconnected, I was like, I can't keep doing
Yeah.
this. I'm not as connected to this world. I'm going through the motions. I'm going on to the next journey,
Yeah.
and I'm clinging too hard to this old journey.
Yeah.
And so I had to let it go. And so many people were like, "Oh, but," and I was like, "No,
That's
this is
great.
it. This is the, it was a great time and a wonderful, wonderful series of memories, but it is over now. I might use the name again, but I'm
Yeah.
not going to do a monthly show with all the rigmarole, every single, no.
So right after university, I started my own theater school. And so for 5.5 years, I ran my own theater school. And it
Oof.
was pretty big. It was like I had approximately 20 teachers working for me every week. And then I realized I didn't like my job. Every time I was in a bar or in a birthday, and someone asked me, "What do you do?" And I say, "I own a theater school." And they were like, "That's so cool." And I was like, "Yeah, I guess." And then after a while, I realized I didn't like it anymore. It was really no fun at the end. So I stopped it. And I tried to give it to someone else, but that didn't work out. So I just had to pull the plug. And that was the weirdest thing, because I built this thing, and there were names and websites and spaces and students, but I pulled the plug, and it was an important life lesson, how it's like the world doesn't end. You can just stop
Yeah.
something
Keep going.
and
Yeah,
actually
it'll.
start doing something you like.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Never be afraid of whatever journey that you have going on, that if you need to stop it at some point, I mean, do it.
No.
Oof. So, slight sidestep, I want to ask you both, because you mentioned the school,
Yeah.
both of you guys teach.
Yes.
How did you get into teaching? And you don't necessarily have to tell me, like, oh, somebody asked me to teach. It's like, what made you think, hey, I'd like to be a teacher? You know, we take these classes, we perform a little, and then what makes us go, hey, I also want to be the person that leads it? So, what led you to that?
Somebody did just ask me to teach. Like,
But
no, you know.
was the person asking you the idea sprung in your head? Were you like, oh, maybe I could? Was that the first idea?
No, Shayna took me to lunch and kind of surprisingly, and asked me to be a TA, and had her eye on me as a future teacher at the time. Just, I don't know, she was looking to expand her ranks and thought I would be a good candidate. And again, that was right when I was getting back into improv after my 5 years 5 years away. So I was trying to gobble up as much improv as I could. So I was more than happy to go in there. And yeah, I don't know. There was never a moment of, yes, this is what I should do. And even now, sometimes I'll be, it really hits me when I'm at festivals. I travel, I was in South Africa in Cape Town, and I'm teaching a workshop to these nine improvisers. And I remembered I was mid-sentence, like I am now, making some point about improv. And the back of my mind, these alarms just went off. You have traveled around the world, and these people are expecting you to say something that's intelligent and insightful and will help them become better improvisers. Freak out! But then the front part of my brain, I finished what I was saying and set up the next activity, and I squashed that. So yeah, I still have those moments. I never had a moment of, I have theories. I have, even when I teach, I feel like I'm only quoting other people. I would almost, as an experiment, like to set up a workshop where I do nothing but say quotes from other people, and just which I think is fine, because improv is all about, recombining what you learn from other people and creating something new in the process. But yeah,
It sounds like you just wrote the blurb for the workshop.
there you go. Yes. Okay.
I would take that workshop.
And you can take that as, Amy, would you at this point just edit in once we figure out the date and time of the workshop?
Yes, with someone else's random voice.
Delete this part. Yeah. No, I'll record a 10-second bit,
Yes.
and then you overwrite this 1 minute with that.
I would
Okay.
like the
That
quotes
seems so
also to be
great.
recorded. So you just play the quotes
Yes.
in the voices
Oh
of
my
those
God.
two.
I could just sit
Oh my
there
God, you should do
and just
that.
click, just next, next, next. Oh, that's a good idea. Maybe I
You
won't even be there. They walk in a room and there's just a tape player. Yes, play me. Just a white room with creepy cameras pointing at them. Ah, this is good. Oh, I think we just invented a show format and workshop format. And a podcast. Oh, we invented so
And
many
maybe
things
like
at
a torture
once.
room. I'm just saying,
And a torture
also, I
room.
mean, just as a combo.
Oh, I'll tell you what. No, it's a total topic switch, but I did a torture room format one time. It was the craziest thing I ever did. Yeah.
Really?
We can stay on this subject. I don't mean to swing it that hard. From here's my silly workshop idea to the torture room format.
I was like, we're gonna talk about it
Yes, good.
later.
Write that down,
Hopefully, I'm
and
gonna
then
write
we'll
that
come back
down.
around to that.
Teaser while I tell you how I got into my
Okay.
teaching career.
Yes.
Oh my God. You know, I just want to say one thing to what you were saying, though, which is that I feel like I've definitely had the voice in the back of my head going, like, you're a fraud. What are you teaching anyone? Like, why are they listening to you? But I also think it's probably because of the second thing you said, which was like, I don't have any theories or like specific, like, I also don't have like this overarching, like, well, I believe this is the way that it is. I believe in improv the same way I believe in, like I was saying, the journey of our lives. So I literally teach you what I'm in. Right there. I'm still teaching, whatever I'm teaching, level one. I'm still going to teach you the basics of what it is, but I'm going to teach you through the lens of whatever I've personally learned in that moment. Like, I'm in a troupe and we just had a rehearsal, and in that rehearsal, this thing happened. Well, I'm going to bring that into class because that's what I'm living, and I need it to be that, but I always think that when I look at workshops and people are like, you can do it this method. And I'm like, I don't know what that, do I have a, me I don't have a method. I need a voice. I don't have a voice. Oh God.
Yeah.
I also,
So there's
like, they
that.
so deeply don't believe that, I mean, it's fine to have approaches or visions, but I so deeply don't believe that you should tell students that this is the way to do it.
Yeah.
Because it's not true. So I will say as much as I can in workshops, if any teacher ever tells you this is how you should do it, don't believe them. It's not true. There are a million ways to do it. And it's interesting to take workshops and learn from people. So whatever, especially if students ask me, but should I do that? Or should I always do it this way? I'm like, no, I'm just giving you something. And if it resonates, you can do it. But don't let any improv teacher ever tell you that there are hard rules. There are no hard rules.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not.
I try to balance that when I teach because on the one hand, everything you just said is exactly correct. On the other hand, I feel a responsibility when I'm teaching to like, well, if I have a point of view, present that point of view. But I try to like add the caveat, like, guys, we're doing it this way. There are so many ways to do it. And after all these years, I still will watch a show and just be, I'll have a moment watching a show after all this time and just go, you can do that? Like, just somebody will break the mold ever so slightly. I'm like, oh, I remember being in a improvised play, like, it was right after my little hiatus. So 7 years ago now, and we were doing this narrative format, narrative play, and at one point somebody just crossed the stage and scene painted and just said, there's pillars and an amazing fountain and all that. And that was a moment of just like, oh, is that allowed? Is that okay? Just, and of course, oh my God. And I've turned that around now and I'm just like, yes, it's improv. Of course it's okay. Do it. Break everything I just said, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. Maybe it'll work great and better than I thought it would, you know?
Yeah. When I finish teaching level one classes, I like to tell them at the very end, when I see you at your graduation, you will be breaking all of the rules I've just given you. And that's all right.
Please do.
So good.
It's like, you know, I'm just showing you where the lines are drawn. You can do what you want with us.
Go outside them.
Yeah, also the lines don't really exist. I'm just a person who used this pen incorrectly.
It's all made up.
I didn't do improv first and then went into improv teaching. I went to teaching first. Mm. Huh. So, yeah. So,
like drama teaching? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I was 19, so I was very young.
Whoa.
I was in a high school where the older students got to... like do little theater plays and dance stuff with the younger students. So I did a bit of choreography and I did a bit of directing. So I got to do all that on like a high school level. And then I was a year into university and I really missed it. I was like, that was so fun to do that in my school. Is there a way to do it? I'm like, you know what? I'll organize something myself. Mm-hmm. So I had this 19-year-old anything is possible attitude, and I organized a summer course for children and a summer course for teenagers, and me and two friends, we started organizing that, and then there was a theater that I wanted to rent, and the theater was like, wait, you're gonna teach it? Great. How about you do that under our name? So we started to teach in that theater as 19-year-olds to a bunch of kids and teenagers. And I was not hindered by any form of education in terms of teaching. So I had this bunch of children just like, you know, let's say around 10-year-olds just looking at me. And I'm like, all right, I guess we're going to do something. So I'm like, I need to come up with exercises somehow.
Yeah.
And so I learned to teach by doing it, by like being on. And one time, there's one sort of moment I remember when I didn't know the exercise. And I said, okay, we're going to do hide and seek. And I'm going to tell you more what we're going to do later. And I'm like, I'm going to make this hide and seek into some sort of theater thing. And I'm not sure yet how. And so I did a lot of teaching theater for kids. And then I thought, oh, actually, I need to keep developing myself as well. That was the time when I still thought, I'm not a performer. So I applied for a theater course, but then the theater course got, I couldn't do it. For whatever reason, and they said, I asked them to give me my money back, and they were like, no, you already paid it, you can't get the money back. I'm like, well, did I just lose my money? And they were like, well, you could do a different course. I'm like, all right, what are my choices? You have no choice. We only have a spot left in improv.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like, oh God.
That's amazing.
I guess I'll do it so I won't lose my money. And then doing improv while I was also teaching theater, it just sort of makes sense to now and then put this improv exercise in my theater class. And then when someone asked me to take over one improv workshop, I was like, you know, I can do some theater things and some improv things. So the teaching felt already very comfortable while I was learning improv at the same time. So I've been a teacher first and a performer later.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I... I would like to connect the two ideas of you being forced to take an improv class and the idea of whatever happens on stage is exactly the right thing, even if you have no idea.
Yeah.
Such that in my life as well, some terrible things that at the time I thought, I can't believe this is happening to me, this is terrible, turned out to be the best thing.
Yes.
And turned around and I was like, oh, wait, I had to have this happen so that I could actually open my eyes to the right thing that I needed to do or that I needed to see in that moment.
Yeah.
Or even just an opportunity. I was like, a quick unrelated theater story. My husband and my car got repoed. Terrible story. I can't believe I'm telling this to strangers, right? But it's okay because when it did, we called him and we're like, super sorry. What can we do to help it? He renegotiated the whole loan and we pay less per month. Best day ever.
Nice.
They gave us the car back without even a dollar exchange from us. They were just like, cool, you want to renegotiate and pay less per month? And we're like, yeah, we'd like that. Can we have the car back?
Please.
And they're like, yeah, no problem. Just go pick it up, no charge. And we're like,
what?
Love you. Yeah. Click. And we're like, we won that one.
Wow.
It's like, guys, you think that's the worst thing that's ever going to happen to you until you face it and then deal with what happens. And then maybe it turns out to be something that's great because, I don't know, something crazy happens.
Yeah.
Like you get forced into an improv class.
Yeah.
Right?
Right?
That's imagine so my bad. Attitude. Like, I'm sitting there like, oh, God damn. Let's do this thing.
Imagine your teacher.
Yeah, right.
Seeing you walk in like,
yes.
This girl's pissed. Who for? Oh, I see. My syllabus says forced to take class. Oh,
yeah,
no.
It's written right there.
I've had a number of students where like they come in and they're like, my boss told me I should take improv. And you're
yep.
like, sweet. Super glad. Sit on down.
Yeah. I love the times that I am proven wrong and that, you know, you can kind of tell the people who are like, all right, you've got a spark in you, like you get
yep.
it. And then these people, oh, you're just struggling through every scene and you're just playing yourself in every scene. And I love being wrong sometimes, you know, whenever some of those people, they just blossom and suddenly they're rocking and rolling and 10 years later, they're still doing it. So like, it's great.
Yeah.
I love the unpredictability of seeing a new class of people. And maybe none of you will ever take level two, or maybe one of you is about to find the love of your life like I did. And I love just the possibility on that day, you know?
Yeah. There's wonderful possibility both in improv classes and in, you know, the journeys that we're on. So
mm-hmm.
I'm glad that you guys are taking full advantage of every opportunity that you can.
Yeah.
Even what we talked about up top, just like taking advantage of the network, not
mm-hmm.
being shy, being like, we've met somewhere random, and now I'm going to call you and say, can I fly
yeah.
far away and come to your home and hang out and do this?
Yes.
Like, wonderful.
Yeah.
The bravery that is involved in that is, like, can last you through anything that goes on in the world.
You do need a certain level of extroversion to be willing to do that. Like, you need to hustle, you know.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, you need to be willing to hustle. I mean, I will get questions like, oh, it just, but that sort of assume that it just comes to me. And I'm like, no, I'm doing this embarrassing thing of, you don't know me. This is my website. If you like what you see there, can we talk about workshops? And then you see they've read the message. And then a week later, you're like, hey, I saw you read the message. Like, you have to do that kind of, the hustle.
Constantly.
The hustle.
Yeah, absolutely.
I need a website.
Part of the hustle, all part of the hustle.
Yeah, no, I was teaching in San Francisco and they asked me for, they asked me for, do you have any photographs of you teaching? And I'm like, that's a good idea. No, I definitely don't.
Okay,
I should take a selfie next time I'm teaching or something. But
it's hard to remember in those moments because I was thinking that the other day too. I was like, I don't have any pictures of me teaching.
Yeah, you gotta plan these things in advance.
Yeah, all right.
I don't even have headshots.
Oh, really?
Never.
Wow.
Ever.
You have a good selfie or two?
Yeah.
That's pretty
what
much these
send?
Days all
you
need.
Just pull off of Facebook when they ask you for a picture?
But that has happened many times already. And I also have one picture from the stage where actually my hands are blurry. So I already have had people go like, do you have something where your hands are not blurry?
hands are not blurry. I'm sorry, my hands are naturally blurry. I can't.
How dare you talk about my blurry hands?
Blurry hand condition.
My family's had blurry hands for generations.
It's our shame.
Actually, one festival had apparently a Photoshop specialist, and they made my hands not blurry. And I saw the at one point they said like, "Oh, you know what? Never mind. Don't send us a new one. We fixed it." At the picture, and I have new hands.
Oh my
on
god!
That picture.
That's incredible.
In my headshot. That's not really headshot.
Was it creepy slash great?
It's super creepy. I can immediately see they're not my hands, and then I'm like, "Well, how can I see they're not my hands?"
I just saw a thing on Twitter on. I know I mentioned what a geek I am, but on Star Trek, Captain Picard had a flute that he would sometimes play, and somebody pointed out that Patrick Stewart can't play the flute. And so for those shots, somebody else was holding up a flute to his mouth, and he's just blowing in it, and this person is doing the stops.
Oh my god!
And it's just a still shot of him. You're like, oh my god, those are not his hands. It's a very unsettling moment.
It's like the arms game of improv, right?
Yes, yeah. It's like the arms game. Yes, he was doing that right there in front of 12-year-old Kevin. Had no idea. Oh
man, the beauty of SD television, right?
Yes.
Before we could see every wrinkle.
They remastered all of that for for HD on Netflix.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
terrible.
Sometimes it's good and you're like, oh, the special effects look better. Other times you're like, oh, that alien is just a guy in a bodysuit and I can see the zipper.
Right? The first time Blu-ray was invented, my friend had a party at her house and she had bought Wizard of Oz, P.S.
Yes.
Don't do that, and played it for us, and it was like we were watching someone's high school play. I mean, you can like see the paint on the backdrop and like the staples and the trees behind them. You know what I mean? It's like, this is four adults wearing like weird costumes clamping in a studio.
Yes.
Like, you could just see everything in a way that was like, look at the makeup on that guy's face.
Yeah,
like, oh, God.
Like,
I couldn't believe it.
I've read how this is a problem for porn. Like,
cause, oh, God! Oh.
Yeah. But, like, you don't want to see that razor burn, you know? Like,
it's too much.
Too much, too much.
Yeah, right?
I think the blurry VHS is exactly the right format for porn.
Yeah, right? What happened to just blur it in post, guys?
Yeah,
just add some blur. Oh, there's a button on iMovie. I know it.
Yes.
Yeah. Come on.
Take it back a notch.
Yeah, right? Ooh.
No.
Or a smoke machine. That helps every movie I've ever been in.
Yes. Just
sometimes you can see the smoke now. Mm-hmm. Like, they've been using the smoke for years, but sometimes I'll watch a movie and I'll see the smoke. Like, I'll see the layer of smoke in the air.
Yes.
Watching a movie, knowing that's what they're doing.
Oh,
I'm like,
they're just
oh, there it is.
Pumping it in the room? Yeah.
Yeah, because it's HD now, so now I can see the differentiation of air. I'm
like,
what? Like, I don't want to see this.
No, too
I
real.
Want these this blurry man and this blurry woman to say things to each other, and that's all I want.
I just take out my lenses.
There you go.
Take my glasses right out. The world is much better.
Okay. That's good.
Oh, my God. Well, thank you guys so much for giving me your time and sharing your stories with my audience and just being so lovely. I appreciate your openness to the chat.
We never got to the torture room format. We'll have to
you can
that
tell us right now, right here at the very end, if you want.
Okay.
Tell
well,
me the torture room
to
format.
It's always good to end a podcast with a torture room format description.
I mean, for me, it definitely is.
That's
I'm
a nice closer.
Yes.
You know, for everyone who listened to the whole episode, here's your treat, torture room format.
Do your shows.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's a LARP format where you're handed a character sheet and... But Mark Major put it up as an improv show, and we're just going to go out on stage. And he got us in character an hour before the show, and we were all members of a like apocalyptic army. Like, we were all soldiers, and it was meant to be very North Korea oppressive feeling, you know. And he had us in character backstage, and then 30 minutes before the show, he came on in character as the drill sergeant and like yelled at us all. And then 10 minutes before the format, he had us all stand at attention and he turned off the lights. And it was like psychological, like, you know, making us feel very uneasy. And the premise was that one of us stole bread and we don't know who. And we don't know if anybody has on their sheet, you stole the bread. You know, it's just a total mystery. And we're meant to be in a room together and just like act out this thing, this of suspicion, you know. So it's a very creepy format already. And here's the interesting thing. At the end of the 10 minutes, he opened the door and said, get in there. And like that was our call to the stage. And we walked out on stage and nobody had bought a ticket that night. Like there was nobody in the audience. And on all other circumstances, you would just cancel the show. But instead, it was just like added to the creepy feeling. And so we walked out and we performed this entire show for no audience. And I remember as we walked out and I saw there was nobody in the audience, just having this moment of like, is this real? Like, just everything that had led up to us. We were already kind of psychologically wired up to just for this to be a creepy experience. Suddenly there's nobody in the room. And in some way is this, and he had like moved chairs to make the stage smaller. So we were all packed closer together. And we played out this hour long, just improvised play of these soldiers trapped in a room together. And people started to break down, and he started to pull people away a few at a time, and it was like one of the creepier experiences, like one of the scariest improv shows I've ever seen or been a part of. So I don't recommend doing it multiple times, but for a one night random thing that nobody saw, it was one of my favorite improv experiences. Yeah.
Was there a tech person?
There was a tech person. So that
So
was the
one
one.
person
Yep.
saw it.
That was the one person watching and the director. Yeah. It was wild. And yeah, there's more to it, but it was a creepy format.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild. That sounds like a great workshop.
Yeah. If you want to really be a psychologically manipulative person,
Well, you could certainly, I mean, at sort of a director's workshop, like if you're an improviser, but you also want to be a director, like the idea of putting yourselves in these like unusual situations and seeing how people react, I think that's helpful when you're a director and you're trying to get a reaction out of somebody without, you know how like when you talk about the actual text or whatever, it'll be like, okay, well, I'm reading the same thing you're reading, but it's just not making me feel what you're telling me to feel. And you're like, great, great, great. So you have to give them like 40 other examples to get them into the thing. Wouldn't it be great if there was like this,
There's just
where you could
this.
just put them in the world and then it's like, now here's the script and you're gonna live in this space, but you're these people.
Being
Like,
these
whoa.
people. Yeah.
Did you ever find out who stole the bread?
No, we found out that nobody had on their paper that they had stolen the bread. So it was all just meant for us to suspect each other without there ever actually being someone who had done it. So,
Oh man.
yeah, it was good. Good
Super
stuff.
Salem witch trial. I love
Very
it.
Salem Witch
I love
Trial.
it. All
Really good.
right. Well,
Okay.
thank you guys.
Thank
Thank
you. So
you.
much fun.
Thanks for being with me.
Appreciate it.
Have a good day.
All
Yeah,
right.
thank you.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.